always exciting to welcome Mr. Scott Nolan back to the studio. He's here to tell us about a show. It's coming up on Thursday. And I'm supposed to remind you, Amanda called during that set and told me to remind you that all Scott Nolan CDs are available at Candor, 390 Provencher. So there's our public service for the day. But we're going to play one off one of my favorite records of the year, and I'm not just saying that because you're in the room. It's a fantastic record. Receiver Reflector, produced by Gerf Morlocks, for goodness sake. The first time I ever heard this song was the last time you heard it live in the studio, and good to finally have it on disc. It's called Settle Down from Scott Nolan.
I'll change my way of living. Be more reasonable. Sometimes I want to let go, and this weight's too much to pull. There's a man on Main Street with a bullhorn and a borrowed cigarette. A little place that we can meet and drink till we forget. We settle down. Sometimes I wanna light it up, bring a little trouble around. Sometimes even I forget that I settle down. And it is in luck, it is in money. This thing from the ground up, from end to end. And I'll be here singing my heart out with all my new friends till we settle down. Sometimes I wanna light it up, bring a little trouble around. Forget that I sell them. To stand, I'll tell you, baby, I don't mean maybe, that I was a lucky man. I've settled down. Sometimes I wanna light it up, bring a little trouble around. Sometimes even I forget. Sometimes I wanna light it up, bring a little trouble around. Sometimes even I forget that I settle down.
Beautiful, beautiful. I've been waiting to see that one on a disc for a while now. That's great. Settle down there, Scott Nolan. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now I just got to clear this up before we go any further. I've been telling people that you had a CD coming out, and because I read that in the paper, and it turns out that's not entirely true.
Yeah, that, as I was saying on the break there, it was a miscommunication, I suppose. I'll say more on my part than anybody's. And I guess how it was mentioned in a press release.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the Canadian Amplifier CD will not be available at the Park Theater on Thursday.
But it is in the works.
It's in the works, and actually, it might have originally would have been available, even though it still wouldn't have been billed as a CD release, per se. There's some legalities. I've used some of Patrick O'Connell's poetry, as well as some live recordings Joanne and I did with a producer out of Nashville. So there's a bunch of clearance stuff I need to go through before this record actually gets out. There's a great old photo of Gar Gillies on his website from, I don't know, he must have been in his 20s.
Yeah.
And the idea to title it Canadian Amplifier was in homage to him.
Yeah.
So I've approached the people that run the website. You just got to cover all these things.
Yeah.
You don't want someone seeing these,
yeah,
you know, down the road. And so he's given me the name of the fellow that took the photo. So it's tricky stuff, you know. I don't even know if this guy's still around. I try a few emails and wait for a reply. A photo is the property, I guess, of whoever took it. So
right. And this is sort of the follow-up to the American Hotel.
Yeah,
record,
my bootleg recordings. I've been, I did that first one on a whim, and I got a lot of really good feedback on it. So
there's some neat stuff. There's kind of like sort of original, I guess, sketches of some of the songs that we heard later on, and some neat covers and fun stuff on there. So it's kind of a different, more laid back kind of a thing than I guess your records proper, I suppose.
It is, yeah. And that, like the idea was that they would always kind of run with a theme, and the American Hotel was for the original songs on the record. They were recorded the day they were written, so you know,
okay,
they're just. They're different. Just haven't had a chance to be played with or changed or arranged, and so that was the idea on American Hotel. The Canadian Amplifier was some live recordings that I've accumulated over the years, as well as demos of stuff from as far back as postcards,
okay,
alternate takes or demos that never made the record. Some tracks off of a record I did with Sky Onison many years ago.
Yeah.
That, you know, they were, a lot of these things were just in real small print. So I wanted to make sure I could, you know, take the tracks that I liked the most and make sure they stuck around. And there was a track of Patrick O'Connell doing an old blues song and, all kinds of stuff that I just didn't want to get lost.
So these kind of sound like for Scott Nolan fans only. Like if I were not familiar with Scott Nolan, would that be the disc that I would pick up first, do you think?
You know, that's what I would say, but it's really hard for me to judge it, I guess, because we toured a lot through the States this past year, Joe and I, and American Hotel sold really well, and people were always drawn to it. Certain people were drawn to it for some reason. And I actually found myself at merch tables, not trying to talk people out of it, but trying to make sure they understood what they were buying before they bought it.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were people that came up and they had their minds made, or there were other people that had heard tracks off their friend's record, and you know, people really wanted that one. So, you know, it's hard to judge what people are going to like. I think, you know, certain people found that refreshing in that, It wasn't a studio environment.
Yeah.
And that could apply to anybody that enjoys folk festivals or so. You never really know.
It contains a lot of what I've loved about Scott Nolan since the beginning, though. You're just very real. I mean, there's no real polish to what you do. You don't come out and try and, you know, do hits for mass consumption. You don't try and dress a certain way for the stage. You just are a real guy singing real songs and just sort of having fun doing them, and that really comes across, the real nature of you, and especially on this record, which is just sort of thrown together in a hotel room right after you write a song or whatever. So I think maybe people are picking up on sort of the genuine nature of that and the genuine nature of you. And
there's a certain kind of flow. I've always had feelings about things like rehearsals and I find it much more interesting what you can command out of people without that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
you know, it's amazing when you work with and there's so many great musicians I know all over the place. It's amazing when you you put a couple of them on the spot, so to speak, and you know, it's those moments that really become about the song.
Yeah.
As soon as almost any player has a chance to really relax into it and has had a chance to think and rethink things, it's really never the same.
Yeah.
You know, there's qualities to both sides, but I really like that, those early moments where people are a little uncertain and, you know, on their best behavior, yeah, so to speak. And
but the list of people who was on the American Hotel is unbelievable. It's pretty much a who's who. I mean, you got the whole Winnipeg contingent, as well as tons of people like Linda McRae is on here, and Dan Walsh, and Gerf is on here, and all kinds of Roger Maron, and it's unbelievable.
Some of the guys in Linda's band too. We ran into them in Nanton, and there's Stephen Akleva and Paul Pagat, who are two really truly kind of underground. Like, they're not as well known as say Linda or even Dan Walsh, and like these guys. Stephen produced I think most of Ray Kondo's records.
Oh yeah.
And these guys are just, you know, incredible musicians. Neither one of them on those sessions were playing their, well, I guess Stephen was playing guitar, but you know, everybody was kind of playing instruments they didn't normally play.
Yeah.
And I was really impressed by what they did, even though those tracks happened to be covers. I thought those guitar players just astounded me with the way they played.
You know? You're pretty good at surrounding yourself with good people. You seem to have good connections or bump into the best people. They always appear on your records, and you do shows with all kinds of cool people and whatever. I mean, is that just sort of the nature of the business you do, or do you like seek out, you know, these people to play with and get to know? Or
I think a lot of it just comes from following certain patterns. I mean, Gerf, you know, I'd say I meet almost all these people in very genuine circumstances, as opposed to, I mean, Gerf, I didn't really seek out in a professional way. We met making a record together, and a friendship grew out of it. Probably never would have made that record if it wasn't for how natural the friendship came about.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we were invited while we were down there on tour, so we didn't even really plan to make Receiver there. And, just different people I've crossed paths with. I met C.R. Avery at some sort of poetry night, Speaking Crow poetry or something like that.
I was going to ask you about him, because he played your CD release party, and really, on paper, it seemed kind of strange. I really didn't know what to expect, and I wasn't really... You know, I wasn't really excited to see C.R. Avery, but he absolutely blew me away at your CD release party.
I went out of my way to bring him, because I see a lot of people all the time, and there's some level of importance in what he does, in my opinion. And it's not something I would typically associate with a performing artist.
Yeah.
You know, and whenever somebody has an opportunity to see him perform and the words really come through, because beyond everything else that impresses people about C.R., it's really the writing at the core of it.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
That gets me. And, you know, it was funny, because I'd introduced him and Gerf that weekend, and I remember telling Gerf before the show, you know, we were on the way to the airport to pick CR up, and I said, you know, you're going to really love this guy, or you're just not going to like it at all. I really don't know. And they both stayed at my house, and it was just interesting. You know, I had a feeling it would probably amount to a lot of music in my home for four days, which is what happened, which is really why I did it to begin with, I think.
That's pretty neat. Of course, we are talking a little bit about Receiver Reflector, your most recent studio record anyway, the one of my favorite records of the year. And I was reading that you weren't really planning on making that kind of a record. Like, you were, it sounded like you were going to do a more rockin' record maybe, and then you got this chance to record with Gerf, or how did that come about?
Well, I had a record that I think was a little more of a natural follow-up to Bourbon.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, I'd been working with the same core musicians that I made No Bourbon with, and it was going in a direction of, like, bands like that I love, like the Heartbreakers, you know? It was really starting to take that shape where, you know, I was still getting to do what I did, or what I thought I did best. Well, I had this thing growing around me where, you know, ideas were starting to come in. It was growing into our thing, as opposed to, you know, being led by me all the time. And So that was my goal, and I have a, you know, pile of material that was for that record. And yeah, Joe and I went, we were down touring down in the southern states and in Texas, and it was after making Rami Mays's record, and it just kind of came up on a whim. Gerf and I had stayed in touch, and as we were traveling down there, he suggested coming by the house, and I took that invitation, and I expanded it into, well, you know, why don't we, rather than being completely informal, why don't I book a couple days or a few days, so we have that space to actually do something in. And, you know, no real plans, whether it be demos or songs that would make a record eventually. And 2 days went into five, and in the 5 days we had made that record. And as Joe and I were leaving, I left Gerf an extra day's wage and said, you know, get started on the mixing, and, you know, we'll talk when I'm back in Winnipeg, because I still hadn't at that point even, you know, didn't really even have the idea that the record was coming out. The label didn't know I was doing it. I just did it on my own money and my own time. And when I got back to Winnipeg, he called me, I guess, you know, a week after I got home, and said, you know, I started working on the mixes on that day's wage you'd left me, and I kind of feel like it's done. And he had said, you know, depending on the artist, he said, I have people come in and, you know, their mix budget could be $20,000, $30,000, $40,000.
Yeah.
He said, I'll be very honest with you. I feel really great about what I've done on a day's work. We could work some more, or you could just listen to this and see. And, you know, that's kind of unique. You'd think he might even stretch it into 2 days just so he could take it easy and work at his leisure. But so that was it. He sent me those masters, and I just liked it. You know, I'd had a really difficult year in that year in particular. It was the first time I lost anybody really close to me. I lost my childhood best friend in a car accident. And then it just this pattern, and, you know, there seemed to be a lot of death around me, all sorts of stuff going on. And so this record kind of, you know, all came together real quick, and I think it reflected that mood. I don't know if it's about that period of my life as much as just really reflective of what I felt like. And then when I heard it, Gerf sent it to me, I thought, you know, that's how I feel, I think. You know? So I decided to put it out.
Well, and it works marvelously. You know, when you think about it, I mean, the work that Gerf has done and the work that you've done, they seem to fit so perfectly, but it's just neat that it sort of came together sort of almost by accident and worked out so well. But, I mean, you're a guy who's made a bunch of records, and you've been a professional for a long time, and so you know what you're doing. I mean, you're no slouch, but when you go in to do a record with Gerf Morlux, and for folks that don't know Gerf Morlux by now, I mean, he's produced Lucinda Williams and Robert Earl Keane and Mary Gauthier and Slade Cleaves and all these great people. I mean, when you go in to work with him, is it intimidating? I mean, it's interesting. Your record is sort of billed as you co-producing with him. Like, how do you put yourself on the same level as this legend guy? And do you feel confident going in? Like,
you know, I really did. I think more than making that record, our meeting and our friendship was very significant in my career, in that I'd barely had a chance to think of what it'd be like to be sitting at a table with somebody like that. And before I knew what had happened, I was there.
Yeah.
So, you know, there, now I'm there, and I'm still not thinking about it. And it was very natural. And long before we made Rami's record, Rami and Dan and I were down in Texas together, and we were at Gerf's house doing pre-production and just working on some of Rami's songs. And, you know, Rami commented at the end of the day that Gerf would often stop and turn to me and say, you know, what do you think? Or, you know, what would you do? And she's, you know, I, of course, picked up on it, too. And, you know, it was real natural. And I think that's what probably led him to work with the types of artists he has worked with. You know, his studio is really just his home.
Yeah.
It doesn't really resemble a recording studio that, you know, one might expect to see. There's really not a lot to it. And I kind of think it speaks a little bit of his nature, too. I mean, it's, you know, there's just a simplicity, I think, to how he approaches music.
Yeah.
And the whole, you know, the co-production thing, you know, from the time I put out my first record, I wanted to produce. And I knew when I looked back, I would see things I might have missed, or, you know, there would be certain things that other artists might not have gone through because they were working with producers. But, you know, everybody I've loved have made records that way.
Yeah.
People say Neil Young made the best and worst records. I have a hard time telling which are which. So I kind of wanted the freedom to make those, you know, same mistakes. I don't know if I'd even call them mistakes, but I wanted to be able to look back on 20 or 30 records throughout my career and see those differences, you know, from what I was trying to contribute. And I'd ask her if up front when he first called and made the invitation, I said, you know, have you done this? Because I hadn't seen a lot of records where he'd co-produce.
Yeah.
And I was just honest with him. I wanted to make sure we had established a little bit of something before going in.
Yeah.
Because I wanted that freedom. And now that it's all done and behind me, I don't think I even needed to really ask in the beginning. I think the invitation stemmed out of that. You know, we had dinner when he was in Winnipeg working on Rami's record, and we'd go out for dinner and talk about music, you know, all the time.
Yeah.
It was just real natural. He reminds me a lot of Sky Onison, who I've worked with for years.
Yeah.
You know, Gurf is very much like Sky, just a handful of years older. And yeah, it was interesting. You know, I don't know if it's like that with all record producers, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be that naive and think that it's that natural. But it really was, you know. I think we both had something to offer it, and that's the reason it happened so fast. You know?
Yeah. What do you think he brought to it that changed it that would have been different had you tried to make a similar record, or would you even tried to make a similar record? Or, I mean, how did he shape it and make it different than you would have done on your own?
Well, I think for the most part, I think what he brought to that record was his experience of getting sounds.
Yeah.
You know, like he has a beautiful old drum kit in his living room that's you know, it was mic'd when I got there. And there were some variances, but Gurf had some great ideas and techniques for miking drums.
Mm-hmm.
And I think on a couple of the more mid-tempo tracks, some of the best drum sounds I've ever gotten on a record. And that I certainly equate to what he brought in. And, you know, I think his key role, because Joanne and I were, you know, so close musically, we had what we were doing down really well.
Yeah.
I think what Gurf did was he helped us assemble it, you know. I don't know if he brought in a lot in the way of arrangements. He just, I think he recognized what Joe and I had and the long history of it, and he tried to come in and be that third person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'd finish a track where it'd be just Joe and I, guitar and drums, and then Gurf and I would, you know, we'd say, hey, you want to try the bass on this one? It was really that loose.
Yeah.
There wasn't any plans, and yeah, so just, I'd say the overall sound, helping us capture it and keep it simple, you know?
I wanted to talk to you a bit about Joanna Miller because, I mean, she's been such a big part of your band and what you've done for so many years, but I've seen you in so many different combinations with, you know, five players behind you and with three players behind you, and lately you've been playing, every time I've seen you, it's just been you and Joanna. And there's something, I don't know, like I've seen you play by yourself, I've seen you play with the full band, and I've seen you, obviously I've seen you with Joanna before, but when you got it right down to just the two of you playing together, there seems something so magical about it that it kind of made me wonder why you weren't doing this in the first place, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. It's funny. We started with, it must have been nine of us.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, is it out of necessity that you just start playing just the two of you, or?
It was a little bit. You know, to be honest, I always, you know, the music in my life, I always wanted to use it to build camaraderie.
Yeah.
I always liked big groups. I used to love living in communal kind of places.
Yeah.
I just really like that energy, whether it's, you know, creating or jamming or what, you know, whatever it is. I used to live with painters a lot when I was in my 20s.
Yeah.
I just like being around that all the time. And so, you know, I always really wanted a band, and I did whatever I could to.
Yeah.
And then, you know, once we really started hitting the road and trying to build a career outside of Winnipeg, I started realizing how difficult it is, you know, with or without money. It's just not an easy thing to do. And so by the time it did get down to the two of us, it was kind of necessity, wanting to take a mix of all the things we thought we did the best out on the road. And for years I'd been looking for those bass pedals, so, you know, that was part of the reason it took us so long to finally do it. But there's no question that of everybody I've worked with, Joe's always been the most invested, and, you know, we really share it. You know, it's not I don't think when we travel, there's never the same questions you might have with other people. Like, yeah. is this his thing and I just contribute this? Like, we have that kind of friendship now where, you know, there's just a lot of things we don't have to ask one another, which really makes it easy. There's just a belief and, you know, the connections and friendships we make while doing it. All these things mean a lot to both of us. So that's what keeps the two of us in it at the end of the day.
It's a great thing, and I mean Joanna is one of the most versatile, underrated drummers in Winnipeg, if not Canada. I mean she plays with everybody, and adds something to everything. But somehow she's never really seems to get that respect or that acclaim that some other people do for some reason. And I think it's just because she so naturally fits in with whatever she does. But I really like when she's playing with you nowadays, it's kind of like, it seems like it's an equal partnership. I mean, you sit side by side and kind of both bring a lot to the music. So I think it's great that she's sort of finally coming to the forefront.
She's very musical too. I mean, so I'm still slowly trying to, create openings for her to do more. I mean, she was playing organ with her one hand, and you know. But I think that's sort of the respect factor. It's definitely there, but it's kind of a typical thing, you know. It's like that with the Charlie Wattses and the Ringo Starrs. You know, the really great ones that aren't concerned with the attention or the solos or that sort of stuff. The ones that are really invested in the song and. Everything, every night comes down to getting that song across. Those are the ones that often, you don't think they get the acclaim, but they really do, especially amongst the musicians.
Yeah.
They're the first ones to see it.
I mean, I guess that's why so many people ask her to play with them, right?
Yeah. You know, I remember when, like, Luc Doucette first saw Joe and I play together. And, you know, I always knew when we traveled, it was never a surprise to me. You know, but you don't see a lot of... you don't see a lot of musicians in general, let alone drummers, that are really in service of a song. Uh-huh. I mean, Jo writes her own songs, and she comes from a very musical family, so she understands this, and it's been ingrained into her, so that's how she approaches everything. But you don't see a lot of that. You know, drummers, you know, when I grew up, drummers, you know, were often the musicians that seemed to come from a different place than I did. You know, they had different personalities, and... So, you know, where she's coming from, I think, is probably pretty unique.
Yeah.
Being behind a drum kit. But she could be almost probably in any role and you know, still shine.
Yeah. You you brought us a live track here that was recorded just the two of you, right?
It was, yep.
Do you want to tell us the story behind this, or?
Yeah, we were in Calgary sound checking when we met actually he's a Canadian, originally from Toronto, named... Miles Wilkinson. He's now based out of Nashville. And he's kind of a musical nomad. He began his career in Anne Murray's band as her guitar player and producer. And he went on to do what seems like everything. Uh-huh. I mean, from winning an Academy Award for sound to he was a key engineer on The Last Waltz. I think he did Willie Nelson's Stardust. He did Guy Clark Dublin Blues. He did a Great Big Sea record. He's just, you know, very eclectic background, and again, another one of those guys, not unlike Gerf. I was just, you know, just this real laid-back character, and actually, when he first approached me, I guess he was having dinner next door to where we were sound-checking. I had a whole bunch of things going on, and I didn't know who this guy was or where he was coming from, so I had a business partner of mine based in Alberta kind of act as a segue here. And you know, kind of stood in for me and relieved me of this situation, and by the time she got back to me, she sat and talked to him for hours and hours, and you know, he was doing a pilot for a PBS program called Acoustic America, and that's where the friendship started. He wanted to record a show of ours on the road, and so we did that in Black Diamond, Alberta, and I eventually got the rust from the show, and I still really had no idea of his background. I knew what he was doing presently, but I had no idea who he had worked with in the past. So when I heard these rafts, I sent him a message back saying, oh, you know, this is okay, but it could be better, you know, in my opinion. And so I had convinced him to meet us again several months later in Calgary, and again, not knowing who I'm even dealing with, you know. So we eventually re-recorded a second show in Calgary with... David Ross McDonald from The Waves opened up, and it was a great night of music. So I think in the end, he was glad to have made a trek out of his way to
yeah.
to do another show. But yeah, we became friends from there, and yeah, he's just another great musical mind, great ears, and you know, he's one of those acoustic masters.
Yeah.
The acoustic records he's made are stunning, you know, like the Guy Clark and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
We just started this friendship. I'm pretty sure our next record we're going to do with him, he's going to come to Winnipeg. We've been talking a little bit about it lately. And just, you know, interesting character. We worked together for, you know, 4 or 5 months, and he'd never said a word about himself. I spoke more about him in these last couple minutes than he's ever said about himself. And I find that interesting. You know, I'm attracted to those people that are just constantly looking forward. And, you know, I'd have a hard time if I were him not talking about myself quite a bit, you know, just from what I've done. But, so it's interesting. And, yeah, we really meshed, and he really appreciated what Joe and I were doing as a two-piece. And that was the first thing I really drew me to him was when he first approached me, he said, this is exactly the kind of music I want to be recording right now. And as soon as he said that, I felt pretty sold.
Yeah.
And he started commenting on some of the more subtle things of what we were doing. So I knew he was, you know...
He was paying attention.
Yeah, I knew he knew what he was talking about. And these live shows, yeah, they come out real well. I'm real impressed with what he did for what seemed like kind of a minimal operation. You know, I've seen people make live records in the past, and it's an elaborate thing. And
yeah,
he's got this interesting. He designed those old mobile recording trucks.
Oh yeah,
back in the '60s, he was the guy that they brought in to actually design them. That did, you know, all these different films and live concerts. And
wow,
so now he's got like the 2007 version. And it's amazing. It's a little studio in a road case.
Wow. Well, let's check it out. This is something live. Scott
Track
Nolan
two?
Yeah, Joanna Miller here on. Oh, we should mention, of course, again, that you're playing on Thursday, right? So Thursday night,
Thursday at the
10
Park
Bucks
Theater.
Park Theater. And is there anybody else playing, or is it just you guys?
It's just our show. It is. It'll be similar to the band I used at the West End for our receiver release, with the exception of Gurf. I have Damon Mitchell, will be on guitar, who I've worked with for a long time.
Okay.
And yeah, it's fun. You know, it's kind of like an expanded version of our band.
Okay.
You know, we got the rock and roll part of our band and our duo, and this is you know, a little more of an ensemble kind of thing.
Yeah. All right, so that's Thursday at the Park. Let's hear this live track. Maybe this will be a little bit of what it'll sound like.
This next song is a newer song of ours. It's the first official step I've taken toward trying to encourage the rest of Canada to recognize Willie P. Bennett as a national treasure. This song is called Drive Day. Everything I'm grateful for. Turnpike, overpass, highway line. Exit 53. Promise of service, a smile. Food, fuel, 16 miles. Bottleneck and a mandolin.
Oh, I like that one indeed. That's Scott Nolan and Joanna Miller there. Now, Willie P. Bennett, a guy not unlike yourself. I mean, I don't know him perhaps as well as you do, but a guy who seems to live and breathe music and is a huge music fan, as well as obviously a great great player. And I mean, the guy just loves to be on stage and do his thing with Fred and whatnot. But how well do you know him? Like, what's your connection?
We have a really close friend, a friend of mine that owns a tattoo shop in Austin. So we have a close mutual friend. We had that going in when I first met him. So, you know, I remember different people telling me, you know, oh, Willie really likes you. You know, like, what'd you do? Because people are kind of nervous around Willie, you know. And I said, I didn't do anything. But I think this mutual friend we have bridges a huge gap. So from the time I did my first Fred shows and stuff, I spent a fair bit of time around Willie. And, you know, I wouldn't say I know him super well. But he is one of those guys, though, I've been affected by watching, you know, like, yeah. it's he's an exceptional human being in a whole variety of ways, you know. I remember, you know, like Willie, when I first met and got to know the Holmes brothers, Willie reminds me of that cut of person, you know, like,
yeah.
You don't see it all the time, and when you come across it, it's very unmistakable. It's just a, part of it is just a pride in what you do, and,
yeah.
You know, yeah, there's just Willie's just real right to the point. You know, he takes what he does seriously. He works really hard day after day at it, and you know, I think I've heard lots of people say over the years, "Oh, I can't believe Willie doesn't do this and
yeah.
he doesn't do that." You know, I think everything Willie does is quite deliberate. You know,
yeah,
he's in control and making his choices, and you know, he still built a legend.
I know.
You know, however he chose to go about it.
It frustrates the hell out of me that the guy never makes records anymore, and he hardly ever does his own thing. I mean, after Blackie and the Rodeo Kings, you'd think he'd be out there all over the place.
Yeah,
but
you know, I'm not sure what his thing is with making records. He's told me, though, he takes a real long time to do stuff.
Yeah.
Everybody's different, you know, and then he works or was working most of the time with somebody that doesn't take a long time to do things.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know, so, you know... Everything comes down to time, I guess.
Yeah.
He's got more time on his hands now than he has. And I know he was, he did some recording while he was in Winnipeg at Jackson's.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what it was for, but, you know, there's no shortage of songs.
Yeah.
Yeah. People are funny, you know.
We'll see him one of these days. You told a great story about him at the West End about, I mean, you just had a heart attack and you were kind of telling the story of that.
I tell it a lot when I play that last song there, just, because I think it says a lot about who Willie is, you know?
Would you mind? Because, I mean, well, I always screw it up. So
this is the report I got, you know, and I just immediately believed it because it sounds like Willie, was that it was, I think it was Victoria Day, playing with Fred, and he'd had a heart attack, I think, somewhere in the middle of the set.
Yeah.
And, you know, knew what was going on or knew something was going on, but finished the performance, packed up his own gear, like he always does. And drove
and
his,
Fred's gear too. I mean,
I always wondered about that. I haven't actually asked that particular night if he tore down the whole stage, but you know, in all likelihood, he did, because that was a part of his gig on the road, and you know, drove himself to emergency. But you know, I think of all the times I watched them on the road, and you know, when I was first kind of joining that camp and doing shows with them, I always wondered too, like, boy, you know, you think he would have reached an area where he gets a little bit of special consideration treatment. You know, it didn't take me too long to figure out that's what makes Willie Willie, is that he's not interested in that, you know. He sets up and sound checks the stage because he's the best at it and because he has no tolerance for anything less than perfection. When he performs, you know, he wants that stage to sing.
Yeah.
And that's why he does it, because he knows nobody can do it as well as he can. And he's right. And, you know, so I'd watch this guy night after night and really learn a lot about, you know, if you're gonna go to the trouble of being on the road, you know, you shouldn't be nervous about trying to be a cut above things. And,
yeah.
And, you know, while other people are drinking and socializing, you know, you should be paying attention to the guitar tone in the mains, and
yeah.
You know, you shouldn't trust just any old sound man that's behind a board. You take a lot of stuff into your own hands, and in the end, your show just becomes of a higher standard. And that's what he brought to Fred's camp, was, you know, he helped build a really great show.
No kidding.
You know, and I'm sure even Fred would say their friendship, I'm sure, has been a great deal of give and take.
Yeah.
You know, I know he's always revered Fred as a writer, and for great reason. I'm sure Fred's learned some tools of the trade off Willie, you know. Yeah. And that's how those friendships happen. And, you know, like what I feel I have with Joanna, I think that's probably where it came from.
Right.
The service of the song and saying, you know what, it's not about me or my legend. It's about this song. And that's what makes those two unique in the Canadian music world is, at the end of the day, that's all it's about.
Yeah.
You know?
That's fantastic. I don't want to run out of time here. You brought your guitar. I'm hoping you'll pull it out of the case there for a song or two. You're playing at the Park Theater this week, and it's kind of interesting. You're one of those guys that I sort of noticed that you play a lot, and it seems like it's not hard to find Scott Nolan playing somewhere. I think you've played just about everywhere, you know, 10 times in your career, but I don't even remember hearing of you playing at the Park Theater once before, so it's kind of interesting that you're playing there now, because I never really thought of it.
I did something once for the Gong Show, I think it was called.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I was just kind of a guest. Like I say, I live very near the Park Theater, and I've gone in there to rent a movie and just have a look at the place. I like those old heritage buildings. And
yeah.
I've been very impressed by what I see them doing. And they're low-key about it. You know, I don't know where they find their funding or how they're going about it, but they seem like they're doing it, you know, much in the way I try and do things, which is just to really work and focus and, you know, accomplish things for yourself. And, you know, and so I'm watching them, you know, renovate the theater, and it's incredible. And I've been paying attention the last several months at their all their progress, and it's just great. I just decided it was time. Joe and I will be back on the road again, so we don't have a lot of time. And, you know, I do play a lot, and I don't, you know. I used to play the Bella Vista every Wednesday, and then we kind of did our farewell show there. And the reality of that farewell show, it was really, it'll sound kind of crazy. A part of it was an attempt to wind it down there a little bit.
Yeah.
I never really wanted to stop playing there. But I wanted to continue using it for what it was, which was a really informal setting to try new songs. And
and
I was trying out new songs every week with a band that had never heard him. It was unrehearsed. It happened in front of people live.
Kind of a practice space with some people there.
Basically, yeah. You know, and it's tough because back when Sky and Joe and Damon and I were doing it, we built up a big following and people came out. And they wanted to be rocked out. They wanted Crazy Horse guitars. And, you know, I started feeling all of a sudden like, you know, it was a gig dictating how it was going to go to me. And so we decided to stop doing it. And when we came off the road, we started doing it again, but just unadvertised and unannounced. So, you know, people that are paying attention to what we're doing know we're there. And, you know, it's always different. 2 weeks ago, it was just myself and Gilles Fonnier, who played bowed bass all night. And I did some loops and mostly just played, you know, a whole bunch of my old songs, just kind of real stripped down. And, you know, before that was just Joanna and I. And, you know, I just try and keep it interesting. But to me, when I'm off the road, if I can't play, I'll just go out of my mind. Got
to
do it.
Well, it's great that you have all those venues then. And it's great that you keep going to new areas. And, I mean, playing at different places for, I'm assuming, different people. I mean, I saw you at the Old Market Square this summer, and then you played at Candor the same day, and you've played at Times Change and the West End. And
that's what music's for. If you're not doing it, you know.
Yeah.
I don't want to get too consumed in all the other stuff. That's what I like to think I do best. It's just play. I'd play every day if I could. You know, that's the hard thing when you come home after being on the road. That's all you really want to do. I need to do it at least once in a week just for my own mental health.
Yeah.
I think I'll play this song by a Winnipeg writer named Patrick O'Connell, who I believe went to university here back in probably 69. He's passed away a few years ago now, a couple years ago. Real good friend of mine, a real great Canadian poet, and I'm always looking for new ways to keep his name familiar to people. I often go to bookstores and order his books and leave the wrong phone number, so I know they'll be on the shelves. So go look for a Patrick O'Connell book of poetry sometime. This is a poem of his called Somewhere Near Regina that I just put to music. Thank you.
how once you lay in a wheat field with a long forgotten mate on warm August earth. The waves of a gold ocean rolled over you. Somewhere near Regina. A white horse in a wind-blown night field, neighing at a turquoise moon. This is a memory. This is a memory. Somewhere near Regina. Walking free, wide rings of fire around a stubble field, smoke in the sky. Somewhere near Regina. Somewhere near Regina. Later the dance hall, drinking outside in the truck, the sweet scent of burnt stubble in her hair. Somewhere near Regina. Somewhere near Regina. In a wheat field with a long forgotten mate on warm August earth, as waves of a gold ocean that rolled over you. You're somewhere near Regina. You're somewhere near Regina.
Very nice indeed, Scott Nolan. Again, playing Thursday at the Park Theater. $10. Good deal, and it's going to be a great show, I'm sure.
Show starts at 7:45.
7:45. Just to meet the middle ground between the 7:30 start time and the 8 o'clock start time.
I thought that was his idea for the park. Let's do 7:45.
Why not?
I liked it.
Do you have one more in there? In your bag of tricks?
What have I got? Let's see here. Sure. This is a road song. Well, there's a chicken coop. There's a guest shack. And that's where I stay. It's out in the back. It's about as close to home as this road will get. Yeah, my look easy, but don't you forget, 'cause out here we drink too much. You don't eat, you drive 90 miles an hour. And you're sleeping, and just when you thought you're on a roll, highway patrol. Say license registration. What's that smell? You're not going to jail, boy. You're going to hell. You caught being a folk singer job.
you might want to start thinking about getting right with God. Cause out here we drink too much. You don't eat, you drive 90 miles an hour. In your sleep, and just when you thought you'd hit the map, you're some new town that ain't even on this map. I don't know how we let things get this far. And my dad told me hell was just an Irish bar. And I knew I'd fail. I seen stars. I gone right off the track. I don't know where you are. I was daydreaming about other people's lives, about a girl with blonde hair and those missing me eyes. And I'm on my way. I'll be there soon. Don't worry, baby, I don't forget your birthdays in June. Out here we drink too much. You don't eat, you driving 90 miles an hour. And you sleep, and just when you thought your mind has snapped, you're some new town that ain't even on this map. Well, I'm getting tired of this. I have my fill. I'd say I ain't ever coming back here, but I probably will. Well, these songs are my sickness, this guitar's a pain. If I'm going out, I'm going out in a blaze. Too much. You don't eat, you drive 90 miles an hour. You count sheep, and just when you thought you ain't never going back, you're some new town that ain't even on this map.
Well, if that don't tell you what this guy's about, I don't know what it will. That's Scott Nolan playing on Thursday, Park Theater. It's on Osborne there. I don't remember the exact address, but do you have it there on your poster?
Yeah, I do. Knowing me, I forgot that part. Oh, no, it was the time I forgot. 698 Osborne Street.
698 Osborne, and a great little venue. I mean, it used to be a movie theater and stuff, and now it's sort of movies and music and all kinds of stuff, so... So great little place, and it'll be fun to see you there for the first time.
Yeah, and it's licensed too, I hear now.
Yeah, and then you're off on the road again, you said?
Yeah, we're off. We head off to we're out west for a week and a half, and then we're home for a week and a half, and then we go south for 2.5 months, just about.
I don't know how you do it. I mean, you must have a gene or something that I don't have, because there's so many people that, you know, after they work so hard for so many years to build up, you know, some sort of an audience, they take it easy, but you're working harder than ever, it sounds
like. Yeah, well, I just, you know, I like to move. Brings the best out of me.
Well, it's you know, it's paying off, because you're making the best records and the best songs of your career by far, and I'm always impressed to see what you come up with next.
I appreciate that.
Always a pleasure to have you here. Let's not wait 3 or 4 years or whatever it's been until you come back the next time. But we'll play one more off the record if you don't mind.
That's great.
Is there anything in particular we should play?
How about All Over Now?
All right, that's a good one. Why'd you pick that one?
I don't know. I like the drum sounds.
All right. It's a good one. And the show is pretty much all over now. The Bluegrass Guy's coming in to take us on our Sunday drive. I'll be back on Thursday, 6:30 to 8 o'clock, Steel Belted Radio. And the next Sunday, 2 to 4 p.m., Tell the Band to Go Home. Check out the website, tellthebandtogohome.com. And here's one more from Scott Nolan. You got a website too, right? ScottNolan.ca?
Yep.
Check it out. Here you go.
always looks like she's leaving. Maybe something's on her mind. She can't walk, she'll crawl and come out on top of it all. It wouldn't be the first time. Don't say that it's over. We've only just fallen behind. And just drive slow, we're off this road. Wouldn't have been looking if it were easy to find. Since you've been gone, it's all that I'm thinking of. What the summer felt like to the person I was. Maybe our hearts fooled us somehow. It's all over. It's all over. Got secrets to hide, and I'm satisfied tonight's the night, the very last time. And since you've been gone, it's all that I'm thinking of. What the summer felt like to the person I was. Maybe our hearts somehow.